Well, friends, my name is Nick, and I'm an addict. First, a word from the sponsor. In Vancouver, B.C., on the September 23rd, 24th, and 25th, we're running the British Columbia Regional Convention of Narcotics Anonymous. And every event needs a good sponsor. This convention is sponsored by BCRCNA, and we'd love to have you all come out and join us. So if you need a trip to Vancouver, come up and see us. I want to thank you for being here. I want to thank you for my life. I was resurrected from the dead in this fellowship. I was brought back to life by who you were. I want to thank the convention committee for the opportunity to be here and to speak with you and to share on the topic that means a lot to me and probably explains why I've stayed around in this fellowship, what kept me here. When I got here, I was I. I was in control. I was doing what I wanted to do. And the I's had it. They took the vote every time. The problem is control for me when I got here, and I was 48 years old when I showed up. I had hair. I was a grandfather. My kids were terrified of me. My business partner made me look down the barrel of a shotgun agreement and threw me out of a 25-year partnership. My wife is living in dreaded fear and has been in Narnan for a year longer than I've been clean. And I think I'm doing okay. And I'm shooting dope in the ensuite in the family bathroom. I'm absolutely delusional at this point. Not just psychotic, but absolutely delusional because I think I'm okay. And it wasn't until somebody in a treatment program said, "You gotta go to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting," that I got any sense of hope, any sense of, hey, this could change. It wasn't until months later when I actually showed up, because the first three or four times somebody said, "Go to a meeting," I'd say, yeah, take the slip from the doc or take the slip from wherever and not go and lie or pretend to go. And when I finally did show up, it was as a loaded addict. I was with a junkie friend. The laundry was in the laundromat around the corner. The chocolate milk and juice stains were all over the T-shirt. We were not styling. But like a good junkie, we're trying to do four things at once. Do the laundry, go to the meeting, and nothing got done. The only thing that happened is I heard two things there. One person said, hey, they'd found freedom from active addiction. And somebody else said, they'd found a way to stop using. Now, to my head at that point in time, those two were impossible. That just simply couldn't happen. So the best I could do right then and there was shut you down, not let you in. But something else did happen. I actually snuck over to the literature table, stole a blue text, put it under the jacket. Now, I'm wearing a coat, okay? It's 40, you know, it's like 26 degrees outside, and I'm wearing a jacket in Vancouver. And I put the text under the coat. Now, 26 degrees, we should have translation services here, by the way, for us international guys, because 26 degrees would work out to somewhere around 85. Okay? And I took the book. And that's how getting along starts in Narcotics Anonymous. Because doubt is actually an early warning sign of faith. The fact that I didn't believe you, that I was going to debate with you, that I was going to doubt you, that I was going to read your literature and determine you were wrong and I was right, was the beginning of acquiring some faith in what you had to share. It took a while for me to actually stay around. I bounced in and out. And then there came this place where somebody said to me, well, you really got to go to more meetings. And I was then in a treatment center. And somebody said, you got to go to meetings all the time. And you got to go to meetings like 90 meetings in 90 days. And it was no longer my will, but their will, right? And the truth was, I didn't like them. Because I was still I. I hadn't become we yet. I hadn't understood what we meant in Narcotics Anonymous. I was going to do it my way. So what I learned is that when somebody comes into this fellowship and they're full of their way and they got it understood and they know this and they know that, I learned that I had to have a whole mess of patience for them because I was just like that. I had it all figured out. I know how to use dope. You weren't going to teach me anything, but I didn't know how to stay clean. And it took me a long time. What really opened my eyes was I was sitting in a hotel room in Vancouver. My family's out in Langley in a suburb of Vancouver, some 35 miles up the highway. I'm in a hotel room downtown. The furniture's all stacked around the doorknob. You know, the carpet's rolled up. And I'm looking through the window at the road below, and I'm seeing what looks like every car is a black cop car. And I'm delusional, and there's a knock on the door. And it's my son. And at that point, like, he drags me out of that hotel room back into treatment and back into these rooms. And one more time, I had to learn that my way was not working. Is there anybody here from Holland? It's too bad, because I was born in Holland. And in Holland, we had this little mantra as a kid that said, ikke, 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 and the rest can sticke. Now, translate that literally or turn that around, and it's me, 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 and you can drop dead. So that was a perfect mantra for the self-centered addict. And in recovery, all of that had to get rearranged. All of that stuff had to get set straight again. And I had to learn very quietly by coming to meetings, sitting around. And at about a year, year and a half clean, people started to force me to do service. See, I didn't do service naturally. It didn't come to me like, yay, I'm going to do service. I'm so grateful to be here. No one liked that. You know, I had sponsors and friends says, hey, come and do this. Try that. Do this for a while. Because by nature, I was lazy. I was not motivated. And I had it figured out my way. So till you dragged me along and made me sit on convention committees and made me go to detox panels and made me go to area service meetings and made me do group GSR work and dragged me through all this stuff, I didn't do that naturally. I learned from you. You showed me that we could do this, that this was a we program. We could be inclusive of each other. And there was room for me in this fellowship. In service, there's, in the concept, there's a line that says, We don't only listen to the words of our fellow addicts, but we listen to the conscience behind the words, or we hear the spirit behind the words. And I think as you stay in this fellowship, one of the great learnings is what that spirit is behind these words. I had the privilege about two and a half years ago of traveling to Kathmandu in Nepal and visiting with a bunch of addicts. And we went to a couple of meetings, and they patiently put up with us Anglophones, because all we could do was speak English, you know, and because they didn't speak any Dutch, and my French was hopeless. So, and my Nepalese was non-existent, but they put up with us. They invited us into their meetings. They translated for us. They helped us through. And then at the point of time, one of them says, "Listen, we want to take you to the area service office." Now, we're in a country where survival's difficult. Just getting along is tough. And recovery is fairly new. There's maybe 30 people in this fellowship. And they have some sense that what they got to do is they got to band together and put together a service office. And they created this office in the side of somebody's house. But what they have is that literature stacked up, that T-shirts and merchandise stacked up, and they had posters and banners stacked up, and they're ready to go. They're ready for whoever wanted to join us. And it was like we'd found a new dope dealer. We'd walked in there, and we knew we'd found the right dealer. And we rummaged through T-shirts, and we bought stuff and took stuff home with us. And it was like we had an awakening of our spirit just sitting with those folk in their service, trying to understand what it took to get along in this fellowship. Because it wasn't just about staying clean. It was about doing something for the guy that wasn't here yet, for the girl that was struggling out there in a country where that was virtually impossible and legally extremely difficult. In the course of all that, we had to learn to apply principles long after we saw the mission. Because getting along, the title says, talking about our mission and our principles, we're clear about what our mission is. Nobody should ever die from this disease. That's clear. We understand that. We got that. But the underlying principles that underlie that have to do with this whole business of how do I care about that next guy? How do I show you some respect? How do I appreciate you? How do I love you? How do I become compassionate? How do I have some humility? How do I tolerate the next person that's coming in the door? Because it's those spiritual principles that allow us to get along. It's on those spiritual principles that we can grow this fellowship. When I came around, I always thought that being rude was cool, that, you know, doing a dining dash was cool, stiffing a minimum wage waitress for a tip was her problem, not mine. In other words, I had no care for anyone. I had no empathy, no compassion for what was going on in the real world. And what I had to learn in this fellowship is that I had to learn to care about everyone. Now, my sponsees will tell you when they drive with me, I'm a tyrant on the road because there isn't a flag person that I want to obey because I'm entitled to drive on the road and the flag person should not be in my way. And it's an area of my life that I've struggled with even being clean. It's like the road is mine. I'm entitled. I had to come to the place where I had to accept that, hey, that person too was placed in my life for a higher purpose. Make the road safe for me, for you, for everyone else. But till I could accept that that person had a place in my life, I couldn't stay around. I had to learn to care. I had to care in a whole bunch of ways. I had to learn to show respect. And when I got here, man, I had a sense of better then because I had a job, had a career. Sure, my partner had thrown me out. I wasn't working, but I had enough insurance to pay for treatment, blah, blah, blah. And I still had half a house, or I thought I had half a house. Because in the meantime, while I was bouncing in and out of treatment centers, my wife had sort of filed the Liz Pendens and actually seized up the other half of the house. So that was no longer available. But what I had to learn that whether you came from a career or whether you came from the street or whether you were healthy or whether you were sick, whether you were alone, I had to respect you. I had to learn to love you. I had to learn to care about you. I had to know that just like me, you came in here because you were dying. And you were looking for a way to get resurrected from the dead, to become our kind of alive, to find a way to live and enjoy life without using drugs. And when I figured that out, then I could also learn to respect the planet a bit. Learn to understand that I could live a little greener, be a little kinder, be a little gentler, and think of my kids and my grandkids, and what does that do for the next generation? Because I'd come in self-centered. It was all for me. I was going to do it my way. What I learned is to respect everything. People, places, things, the planet. The business of living with inclusion, how do I draw people in? How do I make you part of? How do I make you feel part of my life? I had to learn to look you in the eye. I had to learn to give you a hug. Man, for me, when I walked in here, giving people hugs was just sucked. I mean, I hated giving people hugs. I grew up in some staunch conservative community where men didn't do that stuff at all. And if you did, you were gay. And that was even worse, right? It's like, and I had to learn to accept all that. Change my mind on all that stuff. Become accepting so I could include each one of you in my life. And that took a bit of doing. I didn't figure that out in the first or second year here. It probably took me 3 or 4 years to get that kind of accepting, to move past my own biases, to include you. But then what happened is that I got an appreciation, an acceptance for who you were, that I could appreciate the differences. Love the variety, because each one of you has this glorious glitch. Okay? We're not quite normal. We've done something in our brain, we've fried some segment of it, and we have this twisted ability to turn anything into chaos. We can laugh at anything, we can go through stuff. And we can learn to be just our twisted selves. And one of those things for me was learning how to balance the whole business of joy and sorrow, learning how to cope with death and dying and laughing and living the ordinary stuff of life. And I had a dear friend in this fellowship. He died about 3 years ago. And he was mischievous. He was definitely deviant, you know, the kind of mischievous that would, you know, cut your picture off and stick it on a baboon and then fax it to all your friends, and the kind of mischievous that would put your image on a dollar bill and try pass it off in a store, and when he died, we took some of his ashes with us, and my friend Michael, he absolutely hated monkeys, was terrified of them as much as most of you would be terrified of a rat or a rodent or a spider or something like that. I mean, he would just literally freak when he saw a monkey. So we were in Kathmandu, and we had his ashes with us, and we had his partner with us, and this wonderful thing happened as we were in this monkey forest, and we took some of his ashes and we actually spread them in that monkey forest, and we laughed for days because I learned here that we could have that kind of glitch and find a way to sort of process our sorrow and actually find a way to laugh our way through that stuff, and that would heal. That would find us a way to be part of each other, and so we could travel. And it truly became a way that we could get along. It became part of who we are in recovery. About 2 weeks ago, I was sitting with a fellow member who'd had about 15 or 16 years clean in this fellowship, and he'd gone out for about 6 or 7 weeks. And he looked like the skeletal remains of his former self. And it was sad. My heart was just torn. It was sort of one of those moments where you say, this was not necessary. And in the course of his living, he had gone down the life of, you know, the seven roads to the dope, you know, whether that be greed or lust or arrogance or pride, pick any one of them, and any one of them will get you back to the dope, will get you loaded again. But what became important at that point in time, not that I would be judgmental or that I would go to the critical place, but that how could I be loving? How could I be compassionate? How could I be caring enough to sit with them and hopefully get him to see that his wife and his daughters and his family all wanted him to get well, and give him some sense of hope that even he too, and he's only, 2-3 years younger than I am, that he too could get well even at this point in his life. Because sometimes we think that we're too old to get well, or we're, you know, some kids think they're too young to get well. There's no right time or wrong time. And I had to learn that for us to get along, I had to believe in that mission. I had to live by those principles. I had to find a way to take that into every area of my life. In Canada, we celebrate Thanksgiving about 6 weeks before you do down here in the States. So we need a translator again. We get some sense that it's not because of politics. It's not because we have a better Thanksgiving than you do. It's not because our turkeys die earlier in the winter. It's like we, by geographic necessity, have a winter that arrives about 6 weeks on average before yours does. That's just reality. When somebody walks into this fellowship, the reality is we have to be grateful for them whenever they show up. There's a reality to our being available, to our giving thanks for that new person walking in the door. There's another side to that reality, is that when I walked in here, I learned to call you friends because I got to sit at your meetings, eat at your table, I got to listen to your stories, I got to look for your kids, I got to listen to you cry, and I got to laugh with you. In recovery, one of the things we learn is that Thanksgiving is about not the biggest shopping day of the year. It's not about who got the car, who got the toys, who got the girl, who got the house. It isn't about that stuff, right? Thanksgiving Day is about, hey, who's going to come and break bread with us? Who's sitting at our table? Who are we eating with? Who are we sharing our life with? Because this getting along business goes much further than just a meeting. It's how do you want to live the rest of your life? I'm grateful that each one of you allowed me into your fellowship, into your presence, and you shared your life with me. And it's because you did that, I got a life. I'm grateful. Thank you very much for doing that. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. Now I'd like to introduce Carol from South Dakota.
Hey everybody, I'm an addict. My name's Carol. I'm from Rapid City, South Dakota. And if you have no idea about South Dakota, it's extremely rural. Our entire state has less than 800,000 people. And it's like the 17th largest state in the United States. So there's a lot of land with people on one side of the state, and people on the other side of the state, and cows and grain. And if you ever drive across the state, that's what you're going to see, cows and grain, and very, very few people in between. My story begins on October 10th, 2003. By this time, I'd been teaching school for about 24 years. And I was in my classroom, and in South Dakota, and only South Dakota, we have Native American Day in October, where everybody else in the United States has Columbus Day. Okay? So it was the Friday before Native American Day in school, and I got a knock on my door. I was working with some students after school on long division, seventh grade, and the assistant principal came to the door. And he said, these people need to talk to you. And one of the people there was a former student of mine, so I thought they just came by to visit. There were 17 DEA agents. They asked me if they went to my house, if they'd be able to find drugs, and I said yes. They took me to my house after they'd served their search warrant, and I was sitting in the middle of my living room as they were going in and out and everywhere and taking all of the drugs and things out of my house. And I was sitting in the chair and I was thinking, man, if they'd just let me smoke one more bowl, everything would be okay. That was the insanity that was my life. It was very difficult to find a lawyer on a three-day weekend in Rapid City, South Dakota. On Tuesday morning, we contacted a lawyer, and my husband is sitting there. He got arrested about a half hour after I did. We found this lawyer, and the lawyer had read some of the stuff in our files and things, and he suggested that we go to a meeting. He thought maybe we might have a problem. I didn't think I had a problem. The only problem I had is when I ran out. So it took a while, maybe a couple weeks. And he said, have you gone to a meeting yet? No. And he said, let me tell you this, that if you don't go to a meeting, I'm going to help prosecute you because you're not good enough people to be out and about in public. So we went to a meeting. I've not found a need to use since October 10th, 2003, by the grace of God. I used at lunchtime before I went back to school. I used in the morning before I went to school. I was just flying high. But there was a period of time before that that I didn't use. I first stopped using when I was 18 years old, when I graduated from college. And I knew that my teaching degree could not handle me using and teaching both. So there was a period of about 24 years that I didn't use. I didn't have recovery, not at all. I still acted the addict, but I wasn't actively using drugs. I was actively using other things, whatever I could do, you know. This is my fifth marriage. If I got married to you, and I was going to fix you, you know. That didn't work out very well for me or for them either. So when I first started going to meetings, I would listen to what these happy people that were sitting up there had to say, and I was terrified in the back of the room, not wanting to say anything. I listened to what they had to say, and they said, you don't have to use anymore. And I said, even if it's just for today, make yourself a promise that you're not going to pick up just for today. So I said, well, I can do that. I'm not going to use today. People would come over to my house that I used to hang out with. Do you want to catch a buzz? No, I made a promise to myself today. I'm not going to use today, do I? You know, and that grew old for them for a while, so they didn't come back and ask anymore. So that was, phew, thank goodness, because it was getting really hard to say no. I knew that I was going to go to prison. I knew that. I deserved to go to prison for what I was doing. For the first 5 months or so, I sat in the back of that room and I didn't do anything but listen. And I didn't talk to anybody. When they finished the meeting and wanted to do this prayer thing and do the hugs, I'm like, fuck that, I'm gone. I was out the door before any of that touchy-feely crap went on. And finally, I got news that my daughter, who was 24 at the time, was going to have her second brain surgery done, and she lived in Colorado. And I was going to be sentenced to prison in January. And I'm like, well, I can't be sentenced to prison on the day that my daughter has brain surgery. So I went to my lawyer's office and I said, you can go there if you want to, but I'm not going to be there. I'm going to be in Colorado. And I said, if you want to arrest me there, that's fine, but wait, can you wait till after the surgery's done? So she talked to the judge, and the judge said, okay, I'm going to postpone sentencing for 1 month so that I can spend time with my daughter. Which was way cool. And I went down to Colorado, and I spent some time with my daughter and my granddaughter, who was just a little baby at the time. And everything went really well with the surgery and all. And the day that I had to leave to come back for sentencing, my daughter started brain hemorrhaging. And she lived in a little city, Walsenburg, and they had to fly her up to Denver by a helicopter. And that's where I was picking up my ride to bring me back to South Dakota. And I had to leave her in the emergency room with a carotid artery bleed in her brain. And I had to drive back to South Dakota to go to sentencing and then turn myself in to go to prison. And that was about the most difficult thing that I ever had to do in my entire life. Because once you go to prison, you don't get to talk to anybody for a while. And I really didn't know how she was doing. But my higher power saw fit for me to gain the courage to pick up a telephone and to call somebody before I went away. And I called like 8 people on the phone, and nobody was at home. They were all gone. But I left messages. I said, Carol, I'm going to kill myself if you don't call me. Finally, somebody answered the phone, and we talked, and that woman became my sponsor when I finally had the courage to ask her to be my sponsor. And I went away shortly after that on a 4-year sentence. And first offense, that's the only offense I ever had. I was only arrested one time ever. But when you do it good, right? This is my first time speaking in front of a group. When you do it good. You go all the way to the top, right? That's how I did dope. That's how I've done everything in my life. When you do it, you do it. My sponsor told me that I had to take certain suggestions. I had to be willing. I had to be honest, especially with myself. That's a really hard one. And I had to be open-minded that there's something out there that's better than me. And as I went away on my little vacation, I was thinking about those things. And once I got library privileges, I checked out a basic text and I ordered a Just for Today reading. And after I was incarcerated for a while, this woman started bringing in an H&I meeting into the prison. And I got to go to the meetings, and it was really, really cool. And we had a service meeting at a meeting. It was like our own meeting. It wasn't like an H&I meeting. But I was elected GSR in the prison meeting, which is like, what do you have control over in prison besides nothing, you know? Nothing. What happened was I started working with others, not just about myself. And they said, wouldn't it be cool if we had like another meeting where we could do a step study meeting? I said, yeah, you know, because one of my meetings at home before I left was a step study meeting. So they said, okay, do it. You're the GSR. You go get it done. I'm like, okay. So I went with I met with the warden, and I said, you know, some of the girls here would really like to have a step study meeting where we could really get down and work on our steps together. And he said, when do you plan on doing that? And I said, well, we can have a regular recovery meeting, and then we can have our step study meeting after that. And he said, okay. I'm like, oh, God. It worked, you know. And that's not because I did anything. It's because my higher power saw fit that's what needed to happen for not just me, but all the other women that were in there, you know. And we got together, and we did our Thursday regular meeting and then our Thursday step study meeting. And that way, only those that really were interested in working steps, you know, they weren't there just to get out of the cell to come and do something. We really worked hard, and we worked on our steps while we were in there. And I developed a strong bond with the woman that brought the meeting into the prison there. And it was really hard to have my sponsor relationship via the mail, because they read all your mail, you know? No. So I worked my steps with the gal that brought the meeting in. She became my sponsor while I was there, which is like a big no-no in everything that they tell you about H&I service and everything. I didn't know that because I'd never been to an H&I meeting, so I didn't know that that was breaking the rules. But Nina was my first sponsor, and she made me be aware that I could accept myself for who I was, that I could accept myself as a human being, not this monster that I thought I had become. All I could see of myself was the addict at this point. I couldn't see that I was well-spoken. I couldn't see that I had a wonderful education and that I could use that even though I wasn't in a classroom anymore. She made me see that other people looked up to me, which was totally amazing, and that I had a strong effect on the women that I was living with in close quarters there. And she opened my eyes to the awesome feeling that you get when you're working the steps of Narcotics Anonymous. I began to think more of others rather than myself, and I became able to see that my perspective on life was guided by the things that I'd been through in my past, and that your perspective on life is guided by what you've seen through your eyes, and it's not always the same. If you've ever tried to try on somebody else's glasses, holy cow, you know, your whole perspective has changed. And she taught me that my prescription is different than everybody else's on my glasses because it needs to be that way. And I have to be open-minded enough to allow those other perspectives to be there. That taught me how to play well with each other, what this meeting is about. When I got home, it took me a little while, which was only 6 months later. I only had to do 6 months on a four-year stretch, which is way cool. When I got home, I was so anxious to go to my home group, to go back home to a meeting where I knew everybody. They didn't know who I was because I sat in the back and didn't say anything, but I remember who they were because they were sitting up front talking all the time. And I walked up, and they remembered me. They knew who I was. I had no idea that they knew who I was. And they gave me this big, strong hug, and it felt so good. You know, I had missed that hug that I never had before. I didn't know that I missed it until I finally got home and I got that hug again. And the people that gave me that hug, they're still in recovery today, which is a good thing. We've done several service commitments together, and we've knocked heads a lot in those service commitments together. And the only reason that we're knocking heads is because we're both so passionate about carrying the message of recovery. We're so passionate about getting that done. And sometimes I have to learn to surrender in order for things to go forward. It doesn't have to be done my way. And it's okay if we try a new way, somebody else's way. And it takes a lot of humility to say, okay, let's go your way, and to step down a notch. And the rewards that you reap when you say, oh, my God, it did work that way. It's okay. It's a phenomenal feeling as well. And we can agree to disagree, which is totally amazing. I thought I always had to be right about everything, but I don't. And it's okay if I state a different viewpoint. You know, in my recovery, my home group had a business meeting, and we were meeting in the park. Normally we meet in the basement of a church, but they had some kid activities going on, so we met in a local park, and it was a service meeting for my home group, New Hope Group, that meets Friday night in Rapid City at 7:30 to 9 o'clock. You're all welcome. But like this, well, you could almost all fit there too. We've got lots of room. At this home group meeting, they said that they needed a secretary to write down the minutes. I said, I can do that. I know how to write down minutes. I'm a professional, you know. I can write down what you have to say. So they said, okay, you get the position. I said, oh, it's not just for tonight? They said, no, it's for a year. I said, okay, I can do that for a year. So I was note taker, secretary for the group. And then the next year they said, we're electing a GSR. I said, I've done that once. I did that when I was in prison and it worked okay. And so they said, there were two people and I lost by one vote. So this other guy got the position, which was fine by me because I really didn't know what it was anyway. It's a like alphabet soup. But I started going to the area meeting so that I could find out what it was. And unfortunately, the gentleman that was elected to the position relapsed. And went back out, and everybody said, okay, you're it. Like, okay, so I went to my area meetings, which is really cool because I got to take my home group, what we all talked about there, and I got to take it to area and let them know what my home group thought. My home group is the largest NA meeting in South Dakota, which is saying a lot since there's no people in South Dakota. on an average, my home group is 60 to 70 people. In Rapid City, that's about 70,000 people. So the other meetings around in the area are like 10, 15 people for the meetings. You know, that's kind of small. But we have all of the recovery houses bring their patients into our meeting, which is really cool. So our meeting is providing H&I services to a lot of people that aren't able to get it on a regular basis. I'm glad they feel comfortable bringing them to New Hope. So at area, I would, you know, share this kind of information, you know, that we're having a lot of court cards signed. We're having a lot of people from outside come in. It's we have a group of recovering addicts that are young mothers that are pregnant, young to-be mothers, pregnant mothers, who have just started recovery in a recovery house. So they're coming in, and they come in later when their babies are born and all this, which is, it's kind of different. But we've come to a plan, you know, of working together so that everybody's needs are met there when they come in. And at the area level, they said that they were going to have a region meeting. I said, "What's a region meeting?" I don't know. And they said, "Well, South Dakota, the whole state is a region." I'm like, "Oh, okay. When are we going to have that?" And it was going to be in our neck of the woods, which is on the west side of the state. So I went to this region meeting, and there was a position of secretary available. And I said, "I know how to do that. I just got done doing that a couple years ago at my New Hope home group." And another gal from Sioux Falls, which is on the other side of the state, was also wanting the position. So we went out so everybody could talk about us, and she got the position. I'm like, "Oh, well, that's okay." Little did I know that there was another position available that was like vice chair of region. And while we were out, they all decided that that would be better for me to be vice chair of region. I'm like, "Oh, my God, are you kidding?" So I talked to my sponsor about it, and she said, "You can do it." So, okay, I became vice chair of the region of South Dakota, and at the next region meeting, the chairperson resigned. So, like I say, I always go boom, 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 right to the top, right? So I attend my next region meeting. And this is in Sioux Falls on the other side of the state. And this woman and this guy start yelling at each other. I'm like, "Holy cow, let's just settle down here. First, you sit down in your chair and be quiet. And you sit down over there and just let him talk, you know?" So they were both flabbergasted that they'd both been told to shut up for a minute. And like, who's this young kid here? Not young, but young in recovery kid. And I said, "Everybody here has their viewpoint," I said earlier, "about what's going on here. And we need to be open-minded enough to listen to what that viewpoint is in order for us to be able to grow. So this gentleman can finish what he had to say." And he did. And I said, "Now you can respond to what he had to say." And she's like, "No." There's no response. And we all came to the same conclusion that there are people dying out there that don't know that Narcotics Anonymous exists. And we need to get maybe our glass prescription changed or whatever, so we can clearly see what we need to do in order for them to be aware that there is a new way to live. You know? In my state, my region, we have a very high Native American population, hence Native American Day. We have several Indian reservations. The Native American population is dying at an incredible rate because of this disease. At an incredible rate. It's very difficult to get the message to them. The principle that I practice is perseverance. We do have a couple meetings on the Indian reservations at this time. And they're still going on a regular basis. It's about 150 miles from Rapid City, so it's kind of hard for me to take off on a Monday night and go down there and then come back. But they're holding their own. There is some response there. What I can do as a recovering addict and through my HNI PR efforts within the state of South Dakota, the region of South Dakota, is to make the information available to them. I send mailings to the Native American hospitals. I send mailings to the Oglala College. I send mailings to the Sioux tribal leaders. And this spring, I got a telephone call from boot camp, where young kids go in Custer, South Dakota, and they asked me to be a guest speaker. Now, we've taken an HNI panel there every year for quite some time, and when we go there, the inmates are probably 90% Native American. And I shared my story and then asked questions. And their biggest concern is, how do we stay clean when everyone else in our family is using? How do we stay clean when we are ostracized by our elders if we try to have a new way of life? And all I can say is, start a meeting. Perseverance. Keep it open. If you need help, give us a call. We'll come down and we'll help you. Come to meetings in Rapid City. We can show you how we do it in Rapid City. On every Tuesday, I have another HNI commitment every Tuesday, which is called Wellspring, and it is a youth treatment facility in Rapid City. Sometimes there's a Caucasian child included, but not very often. And we share the message. And one of the youngsters there really, really liked the Just for Today book, and she wanted to know where she could get one. And I said, I'll bring you one next week. So I took her one, and we talk a lot about changing playgrounds and playmates. I share that message a lot, that I cannot go back and play with my playmates that I played with 7.5 years ago. I cannot go to the playgrounds I went to 7.5 years ago. I have to put as much effort and time into staying clean as I put effort and time into using drugs, for real. And I spent a lot of time getting and using drugs. So I spend a lot of time on my recovery. I have sponsees that I meet with faithfully every week. I've got like 15 phone calls from them today. This is happening and this is happening. I said, I'll be home tomorrow. I have commitment to be at my home group every Friday. And I sent them pictures last night of where I was instead of at my home group meeting. But I was there in heart. I have a commitment to be to my Tuesday night H&I meeting every week. I have a commitment to my home group because I'm their literature salesperson and we're doing this literature review that everyone in here should be doing for the new book that we're going to vote on at the next World Board, at the next World Service Conference. So if you haven't read The Journey Continues, you should get a copy and read it so that you can tell your RD if you think it should be the next book that we publish or not. It's your responsibility. We take our responsibilities lightly. Somebody else can do that for me and make that decision. No, it's your decision. You are where it's at. I have a responsibility to my area. I'm their treasurer. I have a responsibility to my region because they saw fit to have me become their regional delegate after I was chairperson for them for 4 years. I became regional delegate 2 months before the previous World Service Conference. So I went as a regional delegate, never as an alternate, to the Service Conference, and there I got to see how global this fellowship is. It's not just about rural South Dakota and our huge expanse. It's about Kenya, Africa. It's about Guatemala. It's about Colombia and how difficult it is to have a meeting in Colombia with the cartel right there. You know? It's about Duluth, Minnesota, you know? It's about El Paso, Texas. It's about everywhere in between. And sometimes it's so easy just to think about our little comfort zone and where we are. And it's eye-opening. And it is so overwhelming to my heart to see that at the World Service Conference, there's a man from Iran that got to be there for the first time because of travel restrictions. And he shared with us that 300,000 addicts thank us for making Narcotics Anonymous available. In Iran, there are over 16,000 meetings a week. Fantastic, you know? That is the largest growing Narcotics Anonymous community in the world. Do you know how long it took the United States to get that many meetings? Holy, you know? That was a long time, you know? I spend a lot of time reading about the history of Narcotics Anonymous and where I came from. I haven't been here a long time, but I plan on staying for a long time. And I am so thankful and honored that the committee saw fit to have me come here. I was going to come here anyway, but I was going to sit out there on that side. And they saw fit that I might have a message to share with all of you. And they allowed me the opportunity to be here, which is absolutely phenomenal. And I would like to thank each and every one of you for being a part of my recovery, because without you, I couldn't have done it. It's not what we can do alone. It's what we can do together. And with that, I'm going to take another 24 hours. Thank you.
We'd like to thank Nick and Carol again. And I've asked Deborah M. to read We Do Recover. Thank you.
I'm Deborah M. from Napa, California. Whew. We do recover when at the end of the road we find that we no longer function as a human being, either with or without drugs, we face the same dilemma. What is there left to do? There seems to be this alternative. Either go on as best as we can to the bitter ends, jails, institutions, and death, or find a new way to live. In years gone by, very few addicts ever had this last choice. Those who are addicted today are more fortunate. For the first time in man's entire history, a simple way has been improving itself in the lives of many addicts. It is available to us all. This is a simple, spiritual, not religious program known as Narcotics Anonymous.